Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 22, 2002. Today's session is titled The Earth Bible, Connecting the Earth with the Genesis Story, presented by Norm Hobble. Session number is HAN 2002-17. Let's listen in.
You can start the tape. Directions to the queue, to the people sitting back there. This particular presentation has been modified a little bit because of Steve here. Steve has provoked me to take on something that's part of this sequence of ideas, but which has been modified because I've got an ecologist in my midst, a genuine ecologist, you know, somebody who provokes you to think. So it's slightly modified, but it's, and probably therefore not what I would have normally taught, which is fairly routine, so it's going to be on the edge of thinking about the subject of theology and science, right on the edge. Now, I need to let you know, first of all, that I am the editor of a book called, a series called The Earth Bible. And contrary to popular notion, it started in Australia and not in some other northern country, but it's been published and is a very widely, the fifth volume is about to come out this year, and it's an important step forward in the area of the study of the Bible, but from a new perspective. And those who want a copy of the brochure, I've got a few left here. The actual design here is actually by an Indigenous Australian who was a daughter of the Rainbow Spirit Elders that I talked about a couple of times as well. Now, the important thing, and I have to be very brief just to introduce this so I can get to the actual topic itself. The important thing that some years ago we began to realize is that when most of us read the Bible, in almost every Bible study course that you've done, you've probably done, what, Crossways or one of those, one of the Bible training. Most of the Bible study courses do a survey of the Bible and they focus on two of the great narratives of the Bible, the story of God and the story of humanity, or the people of God. And what's ignored most of the time is the story of Earth. And next to the word God, the word Earth occurs more than any other. Extraordinary, therefore, that the story of Earth has been ignored. And so what we have been trying to do is to say, what do I do now to be able to read this story, the story of Earth in the Bible? And how do we go about it? And how do I read it so that I am actually in some way or another being honest and fair to Earth? Because most of the time we've simply not really been concerned about Earth, we've been concerned about ourselves as human beings, and we've been concerned about our relationship to God. So if I'm telling any story, one of the important things if I'm telling a story is that I'm going to look at the characters in the story. And in this case, if I'm a feminist, I'm reading the story, I'm tended to read the story from the perspective of women, the women of humanity, and so on, and all that kind of thing. So what we're asking now is, if I, when I read the stories, try to identify with the key character of the story, namely Earth, as opposed to human beings or God or somebody else, and I'm looking at Earth as the primary character, and I believe the story of Genesis 1 is a story about Earth, first and foremost, and we'll come back to that later. How do I read it from the perspective of Earth? What kind of questions am I going to be asking which are going to mean that I am true to Earth as the character, true to the perspective of Earth? So the first volume is simply an introduction with examples of reading the Bible from the perspective of Earth. Now, I'm not going to go through all of the processes. I want to simply make another preliminary point, and that is frequently, or most of the time, we who are in the Western world, as opposed to some of the Greek Orthodox, have become what I would say called disconnected from Earth. So it's difficult for me to put myself in the position of Earth because I've had a history of getting disconnected. And all kinds of things in our life and the way we function and the way we've taught and the way we've thought about science and the way we've thought about our lives and our theology have disconnected us from birth. What's an example in your mind of how we've disconnected ourselves from birth?
How we're taking care of the earth.
Well, let's compare, for example, let's compare earth with heaven. Which is more important for most of us?
Heaven.
Why?
Because that's where we're going.
That's where we're going. In other words, we have said, well, I'm going.
Right. Okay?
Huh? What? Hopefully, yes. Inshallah.
You're all sound asleep.
Right? If I'm going to heaven, heaven somehow or another is more important. Heaven is portrayed as being, the earth is portrayed as being material, and heaven is portrayed as being spiritual. It's superior. Earth is inferior. Heaven is the place where God dwells. Earth is the place where we are, temporarily. So what has happened is all kinds of reasons why, spiritually, we've seen that our real home is in heaven. And earth, on earth, we are simply pilgrims, all that kind of language, you know? So the whole idea that, well, let's face it, you know, it doesn't matter if the earth gets destroyed because after all we've got a real home, it's in heaven. So it's easy to put heaven on higher and superior because we've been taught in many ways. When I was a kid, you pray to God, you don't pray to God in earth, you pray to God in
Father who is in heaven.
Right? And so all the language somehow or another puts heaven as being that which is important and earth as unimportant, and so we have this disconnection that takes place. We don't have this sense of kinship with the earth or feeling for the earth that so many indigenous peoples have. You listen to the indigenous people. I've worked with them in Australia, the indigenous Australians. And the spiritual source of things is earth. Not the sky. Not heaven. The life source of everything is earth. And so we're concerned about this sense of, well, I'm concerned about this concept of separation. And a lot more could be said about it. We've got this famous hymn, which I've totally rewritten. You know, guide me, O thou great Jehovah, pilgrim through this barren land, right? So earth is this barren land, heaven is paradise. We've got all that imagery. It does nothing to help earth when you start having that. So I've totally rewritten that song, which is to make earth the exciting place to be. And we sang it. A couple of weeks ago. Now, that's one way in which we're disconnected. And I do a whole lot of study and work with it, trying to connect up. How do we make the connection with Earth? And one of the different ways of making connection to overcome this disconnection. Now, today, I'm going to focus especially on the question of the disconnection, not so much the spiritual one that we've made, but the one that we've made in terms of science. When our perception of science, now we've got a scientist here who can tell me if I'm wrong, our popular perception of science is that what do you have to do to be a really good scientist? I'm going to look at Earth and I'm going to be
rational.
Rational, absolutely, beautiful word, absolutely. You have to be rational. That is, and our Western mind is that the reason is the thing. The emotions are going to get in the right way, right? I've got to be rational. I've got to be, what else?
Objective,
precisely. And I've got to be objective, rational, objective, what else?
Detached.
Absolutely, another right word. Detached. So if I'm going to be a good scientist, and I'm going to look at Earth, or the trees, or the mountains, or whatever it is, I am going to look at it. Now, I can't get involved. This is out there, and I'm separating myself from it. I'm not saying that that's what scientists actually do, but that's the perception, the popular perception of what a scientist does. So once again, you, as it were, disconnect. You separate yourself. You make this the object of investigation, right? And the question I have is that what contemporary scientists are doing? Are they still there? Or have we somehow missed it? Or putting the question this way, for today's session, how do I connect with Earth in such a way that I connect with Earth, even though I am connecting with Earth as a remarkable scientific or piece of science. As a scientist, I want to go back to the scientists of the Bible who are called the wise, and see how they connect with Earth. And ask my scientist friend afterwards whether or not there's any kinship between what the scientists of the Bible did and the scientists of the biblical past did, and what the scientists like some of the great scientists of today are doing. Making connections, or having a connection which most of us don't read in the Bible because we are reading it, you know, in terms of, well, how do I live my life and what's God saying and all the rest of it. And we haven't actually recognized that there is in the Bible a massive or fascinating section of material which is about what I would call science. The science people of the Bible. Yes?
Just one other perspective on science is, you know, sometimes it depends on who pays their salary, it seems like.
I don't get paid for this.
No.
A lot of the scientists who were working for the tobacco companies clearly found certain evidence, didn't they?
Yeah.
Huh? Quite clearly. Yeah.
Norm, when you refer to Earth and the Earth Bible, what do you consider Earth?
Well, I first and foremost mean this planet. In the Bible, Earth can be used to refer to three different ways. It can refer to simply the land over against the sea, or it can refer to all of Earth, or it can be referred to the sky and the earth, that is Earth, and as a complex sky and earth. We often say heaven and earth, but in the Old Testament it means sky, not some place where God sits. So you're talking, but first and foremost I'm referring to what the people in the Old Testament from the biblical world knew was the physical domain where they lived. They didn't know about galaxies, although they didn't know about, you know, different designs in the sky. But so it's basically what I'm talking about is planet Earth. And I always use a capital E when I talk about Earth in this stuff. All right, now I want to take you into some texts. Three texts which have what I consider a basic science. I'm calling it science. You may not want to call it that after I'm finished, and I want you to look at it and see what it's about. See whether you connect with it, and especially whether my science friend connects with it, and even his family connects with it. Okay, but it's partly because somehow or another sometimes you need to be challenged. Now I want you to turn to Job chapter 38. At the end of the great speeches of Job, and Job presents his case to God, God finally answers Job. And God answers Job from the whirlwind, and we often think, what a wonderful piece of poetry, and ignore that there's more than poetry in the story. Now I want to go through this, it'll take us a few minutes to do so. Read through each section, and I want you to tell me what the poetic metaphor is, because each one tends to have a poetic metaphor or symbol to it. And then after that, I want to point you to a piece of scientific data or a scientific concept which is embedded in that piece of poetry. Each piece of poetry. Because you see, it's the poetry around the observation of the natural world. And I'm wondering whether any of you feel the connection with this, and how you might make that connection if you're doing a little bit of observation of the natural world. It all starts off with a key line in 38 verse 2. Who is this that darkens counsel? A better translation than counsel is a Hebrew word which really means design. Who is this that obscures my design? Job has been saying that God is chaotic, nothing's ordered, and all the rest of this place is a mess. And so the key word that starts the thing off is, who is this that's obscuring the design? Another way of saying it is cosmic design. And so he goes to the first whole chapter is about the physical universe and his analysis of the physical universe. And while God is asking the question and challenging Job, somebody has figured out the questions that God has to put. And they are questions that link up with their understanding of the universe, the mysteries of the universe. Now I'm going to go through and look at each of these. The first section, 38 verses 4 to 7. Somebody want to read that? Okay.
Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy.
Okay. So the first piece of the cosmos God is looking at is the physics, is Earth. Right? And what's the metaphor? It's the construction of a building. Foundations, cornerstone, and when it's all finished, you have what? A big celebration, everybody sings. It's a metaphor, it's the construction of a building. But deep within that construction, there is a couple of key words. Key words that are more than just pieces of poetry. And one of the key words is the word foundation. And you get that term being repeated time and time again. It refers to the deep structure of something. So while Job is put, God is saying, well, were you there when I built it all, so forth. In the middle of it all, there is a key word, and the word is foundation or deep structure. So Job is being challenged by God. But somebody has figured out these terms. You know, they're using what we would call scientific terms, technical terms. And all of the deep structure, all of this has been carefully measured. So the cosmos is not simply a random thing. It's something that's got design and measurement and all those kind of things that belong to it. That's the first one. Then the second one is a beautiful piece of poetry. And you say, well, that's just poetry, but it's not. Look at verses 8 through 11. Who wants to read that?
I'll read that.
Okay.
Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made clouds its garment, and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed bounds for it, and set bars and doors, and said, thus far shall you come, and no farther. And here shall your proud waves be stayed.
All right, this is about the sea. And what's the metaphor?
Baby being born?
Yes. The picture of sea, which is huge and vast, is portrayed as being born like a baby. All right, came out of the womb, and then you wrap it up, in the atmosphere and the cloth, you wrap it up, and then you put a little playpen around it.
Just the land.
Yes. And then you say, you have what? Limits. The structures of the earth, the structures of the sea, is that built into the design of the cosmos are boundaries for the sea.
Why?
Huh?
My mom is good. Take a nap.
The boundaries to the sea, okay? The limits of sea. Now, each one of these passages has a similar thing. Now, I'm not going to have us read all of them, but let's take a look. The next one in verses 12 to 15 is all about the dawn. All right? Here's the dawn. And the striking thing is that the dawn, it says, I'll just read the key verse. Have you, verse 12, commanded the mornings or the dawn since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place? So there's a technical term there for place, the locus. That particular item, that particular thing called dawn, has a locus, a place, where it fits in the design of things. Do you know where dawn fits? So that it comes up each morning, it's there every morning. It says nothing about the sun, it talks about dawn as being a distinct entity, a kind of emergence of light, and so on. So each thing has its technical This one is placed. And that term, by the way, placed, will keep coming back as we read more texts. It's a technical word for where something fits into the design of God's cosmos. Okay. Then verses 16 to 18 is the next one. Have you entered the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Now comes this one. He's talking about the deep. And the deep is a crucial part of the cosmos in the ancient world. It is the deep structures below. It's the deep below. In other words, the earth is not simply what you see, but beneath it there's another massive designed world, which includes the world of death and a few other things. So there's another deep below which has its own structures, like the structures of earth. And the deep you will have to keep in mind, because we'll keep coming back to that. Then verses 19 to 24. Where is the way to the dwelling of light, and where is the place of darkness? He comes back to the same thing, and he then says, where is its way? The way of light and darkness. Now, it's often translated the way to something, but I will, just in a moment, you make a point that way should not be translated way to, but the way of something. I'm picking out those things which are the technical science terms as distinct from the poetry. 25 to 27. Who has cut a channel for the wind and the way of the thunderbolt? So here on this business about the weather again, there's a way which the thunder has, or the thunderbolt. Now verses 31 to 33. Can you bind the Pleiades, the chains of the Pleiades, or the cords of the Orion? So we had... The stars. In other words, the stars aren't just random. They're somehow, somebody controls them and puts them in their place. Do you know, verse 33, what's your translation? Ordinances. Now we've got the sky. And in the sky, there's a key term which is otherwise translated laws. The laws of nature, we say, the laws of the sky is a biblical term. The sky has laws. And so the stars stay in certain places, in certain arrangements. And if you know the laws of the sky, can you see them connected with Earth? That's the next verse. Is there a connection between the laws of the sky and the laws of Earth? In other words, there's far more to this than simply a piece of poetry. And I'll run through the last one. Then verse 34 to... all the way to 38. He's talking about the clouds, which is the last one. And here are the clouds. And what is it, he asks, are in the clouds? Can you see in the clouds what? Wisdom. Now I want to stop for one moment with this picture. We have within this picture certain deep structures. The structure of the deep below, the laws of the sky, the limits of the sea, the place where dawn fits, the way of light, the way of thunder, and the wisdom in the cloud. All these are technical terms in the wisdom thinking of the ancient world. And the wisdom people are the science people. Okay? Now, take a moment on this word way. If you want to know the Hebrew, it's Derek. My computer always came up with a capital D every time I printed it. Derek. The way of something is its driving characteristic. There's a passage in chapter 6, verse 6 that says, consider the way of the ant. It does this, it does that, it collects things in summer. The way of something is what makes that thing tick. What makes that thing work? The distinctive driving impulse of that particular thing. So the way of the ant is to do certain things. And the way of the ant is quite distinct from the way of the eagle, which flies in the sky. Everything has its way. And I would call that its driving impulse. That which characterizes it, and thereby it does what it does. And in technical terms, I sometimes think it's equivalent to something, the code that's inbuilt into something. We say, at least some scientists are, it says everything has within it a kind of inbuilt code to do what is its thing, so that a tree doesn't turn out to fly, doesn't fly, does it? Because in the tree there is a code of impulses to do what it does. And so the word way means that which is the inner code, inner impulse, the driving force inside of something to do what is its thing. It's not quite the same as instinct, but there are some connections there. Okay, so I want to pause there for at this point and say this is one of the key terms which are equivalent to an understanding of how they have analyzed the natural world in the world of the wise scholars of the ancient world. The way is a key term. Questions? Are there any people? Am I losing you? Or is it too scientific? Okay. Are you with me? Yes. Still, let's see.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Okay. I know I'm in a bit of a biblical world, but I'm hopefully making some sense.
Okay.
All right.
Just out of curiosity, how old is this text?
Ah, that's a good question. The answer is I don't know, but I'll give you a rough
ballpark
figure.
He's Aussie. He'll be a cricket.
But yeah, they're not a ballpark figure. You want a cricket field figure. All right. Thank you for that. It's the ballpark figure is that it's probably written somewhere in the 6th century BCE. It could have been written earlier and then incorporated. But it's not at all clear because we have absolutely no historical allusion anywhere in the Book of Job. So you have no way of knowing when it was written. It doesn't refer to any king or prince but it does refer to this world of ideas. And this world of ideas about wisdom and the structure and the design of the world is not just in Israel. You find it in Egypt, in Babylon, so it's a kind of across the world, across the ancient world. So what we've got now is this whole idea that there's a cosmic design, which introduces that chapter, and one more word, and that the word wisdom is elsewhere and in the background, and this is, remember, it's the school of wisdom, the wise, the teachers of wisdom, and the key word for wisdom, I would say that the best way to perhaps interpret this word so that it's reasonably clear is to talk about wisdom as the, well, given this design thing here, wisdom is basically the ordering or creating impulse.
So the way is a driving impulse, but wisdom is a creative impulse.
All right, and each, the underlying behind the scenes overall thing is called wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And each thing in the design that wisdom is involved with has its own individual way.
Okay.
So there's an overall, overarching, creating, ordering impulse that structures the world. Behind that, within that, each thing has its own individual way. So you've got your way, which is a particular way of, you know, being and living, and you know, and you have your way, which is distinctive to you. It's the inner impulse that belongs to you. The way is the driving force, the impulse that lives in an ant, that makes an ant an ant. The essence of ants. But it's not just in some abstract way, it's what makes the ant actually function as ant, operate as ant, right? Or a tree function as a tree, or a molecule function as a molecule. Each has its own code, but the overall behind-the-scenes thing that is behind it all, that is the eternal impulse of it all, is called wisdom. Now comes the question. Please come in. You're just at the key moment. Just in time to ask the key question. The key question and the big question is, where do you find this thing called wisdom, this impulse, this ordering impulse in the universe. Where do you find it? How do you find it? Who found it? Who found it first? And now I want to turn you to turn to another chapter. This time it's Job 28. We'll get to Genesis eventually, in case you came here just for that. Now, Job 28 is, I believe, one of the most, basically just an ignored chapter in the middle of the book of Job. But what you discover if you turn to Job 28 is, we'll start with, say, verse 28, verse 12. Where can you find wisdom, and where is its place? Remember we said that one of the technical terms here is the place, where something fits into the cosmic structure of things. So where does wisdom, that is the thing behind it all, where is its place? Where do you find the place of wisdom? Who's found it? Has anybody found it? And this whole chapter seems to suggest nobody's ever going to find it. It's just too hard. But is it? The deep, verse 14, says, well, it's not in me. And the sea says, no, it's not just in me. And then a little bit later, verse 20, where then does wisdom come from? Where is the place? Verse 20. It seems to be hidden from the eyes of the living. Verse 24, Abaddon, which is the world of destruction below, and death said, well, we heard a rumor about it. Wonderful little line. Then comes a piece of text which has largely been ignored. And I want you to spend a little close reading of this one. Verse 23. God understands the way. Now the Hebrew doesn't have the word to. Of it. God understands the way of wisdom. If everything has its way, there's a way that's beneath all ways, which is the distinctive dimension of wisdom, the driving impulse behind all ways. Who knows it? Who knows this? So what are we doing? How are we portraying God then? We'll think about it. What is unusual about this portrayal of God? God knows its way, its place, where it fits into the design of things. Now, verse 24. God looks where? To the ends of the earth. And God sees everything under the heaven. So what is God doing? What is God doing? What is God doing?
He's seeing. He's watching.
What's he looking at? He's watching, he's looking.
The earth.
Yes, he's looking at the earth. He's looking at this whole earth. He's looking at the whole thing. He's taking a long look at everything as far as he can. Right? What's that called when you actually observe closely something? Study.
Examine. I was thinking he's putting it in perspective.
Yes. He's taking a look. God is looking at the whole of creation.
It's a scientific thing.
God the scientist.
Yeah.
Apprehension.
Observation, apprehension, analysis. So you've God the scientist. This is a portrait of God. In the Bible they were called God the wise. God the sage. Here it's God, we would say God the scientist. God analyzes the whole of creation. Because we're asking, where is this thing called wisdom, which is the creative impulse, the ordering impulse behind it all? So God looks at this whole thing that's on the all the cosmos, all the creation, and then having looked at it, then verse 25, when God gave the wind its weight, heavens above. We have wind actually over here. When God gave the wind its weight, how heavy is the wind?
We can move houses.
Yeah. But there's a mystery in that, you know. When God measured the weight of the wind, that's what a scientist does. Measures the weight of things. God measured the weight of the wind, right? And when God, what? apportion out the waters by measure. In other words, when God fixed where the parts of the sea are, we're back to the same picture. When God ordered the seas and where they belong, when God
created the tides.
Created the tides. Absolutely. When God apportioned the waters by measure. Now this is all
scientific words.
Language of science. Yeah. When God did all this scientific investigation as he was creating it, then verse, and the next one, when God made a what? Decree for the rain. That's the same word as here. A law for the rain to do what it's supposed to do. Right, same term, technical term. When God made a law of nature, we call it still today. God made a law for the rain, and quote what? For the thunderbolt.
Way.
Back here. When God made a way for the thunderbolt. So when God was doing all these ordering of the pieces of the cosmos, at that point, when he was doing all that ordering and saw the way of everything and how the impulses of everything came together, then what? Then what? Next to it. Then he saw it. Wisdom. And he declared it. Boy, there she is. And he... No, missed the chapter. Established it. And the last word... And then he searched it out. You can't have a more scientific word in Hebrew than that one. God found wisdom. God the scientist discovers wisdom in the ordering, in the design of creation. Isn't that fascinating? Or isn't it? I think it is. God is portrayed here as doing what the wise did. That is, they observed things, they analyzed them, and they tried to discern what is the distinctive driving impulse, the ordering, creative impulse of anything. And then they asked the question, what's the impulse behind all the impulses? What's the creative ordering impulse behind all of them? And they called that wisdom. And they found, and this text says, the first person to discover that
was God.
You don't have it as though God's sitting there, oh, I'm such a wise person. You have God searching for it, looking for it, discovering it. Questions? Is that clear to you?
Mm-hmm. So this go ahead,
Rich. It seems like only God has that kind of wisdom.
That's what it seems like here. Yeah, but in fact, of course, if God's got it, and you fear God, then you can follow on and do it too.
Right. This is Einstein's God.
Yes.
But this is the God then that Abraham can argue with. This is the God that can make deals with people. This is the God that can change his mind.
And this is the God in the book of Job. This is the God in the book of Job, where Job argues with God and talks with God, and this is the God, and where you can argue about the way the world is structured. You know, Job has this thing in chapter 12. Or by the wisdom you hold the reins back, and by George, some of your wisdom is not what I would like, you know. So you've got a kind of capacity in the world of the wise, not just to say yes to God, but to have a dialogue with God. And when God answers, God has a dialogue with the scientists. He says, well, were you there? You know, what do you know about? You know, but of course, they do have to know about it because they already have these concepts of it. God's not revealing new things. He's talking about things they already knew about in their world, in their understanding of the scientific structure of the universe.
There's one scientist has said that science is a conversation with nature. And it's a dialogue, and science moves dialectically, or it doesn't move at all.
Mm.
So when I see this, I see a very, very familiar...
A model.
Process.
Mm. Yeah, precisely. It's a dialogue in which God began, God discovered something, and now he has the dialogue with the wise who can also discover it. Okay. Okay? You sound like you're a scientist. Mm. Any other questions? Yeah?
It seems strange that God would see it, but not, and declare it, but not create it.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering that
when he was creating the universe that he discovered
that it's a byproduct of all of these other things. Oh, well, business, and then I have this process as a result, and...
Well, there's a sense in which it's almost like God's, well, look what's here. You don't have a God who has it all, as it were, mapped out neatly. You have a sense in which you have a God which they talk about as a God of process. That in the process of it all, you know, even God, it seems, comes to an understanding what the heck's all there.
So that even God would have a sense of discovery.
Absolutely.
Which is that the fourth?
Sense of discovery.
Yeah.
God has a sense of discovery. Now I'll just jump ahead to the Genesis text. God has a sense of discovery. When God sees something and he discovers that it's there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the story, the way it goes in Genesis 1? And God said, let there be light. And God looked at the light, the same expression, looked at it, and said,
it's good.
Wow. I discovered that's pretty good.
That's
good. The same language. We've tended to say, well, God was saying, you know, it's good, 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 just morally or some other way. But it's this delight in the discovery of what he's made that's there. The language. For example, when the baby Moses is born and the mother has it, it says, and the baby was good in her eyes. In other words, how did she feel about it? Terrific. So you've got the same sense of God, as it were, creating, discovering, and then responding to the what God has made. The sense of response to God's own involvement in the creative process.
Does this have any relationship with evolution in terms of God sort of setting us in motion and then discovering
it's not, of course, they don't know the theory of evolution in the ancient world, that's clear. But what you do have is a sense of, when I use the word impulse here, the impulse in everything to be and emerge and develop the way it is designed to be is very close to some of the concepts of evolution. Very close. But, of course, they don't know all the fine details. But what you do have is a kind of impulse behind all the inner. Each one has its own impulse, its own code, its way it's supposed to function. You know? Four things amaze me. You know, the way of a snake on a rock, the eagle in the sky, and so on. That's where the word way means the inner driving characteristic of something. All right. Now I want to take you, I already hinted one aspect of Genesis 1. I need to take you one more step in all of this, and that is to go to Proverbs 8. Now Proverbs 8 is one of the famous texts that is very, very important in the whole understanding of God as being something not quite, you know, the masculine figure that we've tended to see. But Proverbs 8, starting with verse 22, you cannot understand the full dimensions of this thing called wisdom unless you jump ahead to Proverbs 8 and read that text. And here I want to modify a translation to make it clearer what it's saying. Okay. Proverbs 8. The Lord created me. Whoops. Who's talking?
Wisdom.
What's happened is that this figure called wisdom is given a voice. This ancient eternal impulse behind the cosmic design of things is given a voice, and wisdom begins to speak. So suddenly we have a consciousness of the creative impulses of the universe, the life forces of the universe, as not simply there, but as alive.
Well, John says Jesus was at the beginning, at creation.
You know, the Word was at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go back to that. We'll come back to that. Let's work this one through first. So wisdom says, I was there. Now, if you read the text closely in Hebrew, there's a key thing that's ignored. It says in most of the translation, I was in the beginning. Alright? God acquired me at the beginning. And a good translation of that is acquired rather than created. In any case, remember the previous chapter, God found wisdom? So the word there, the word that's used there, kana, everywhere else in Proverbs, that word means acquire. Acquire wisdom, acquire. So God acquired wisdom, right, at the beginning. And then it says, his way before his works. Now, because the translators were unhappy with the actual original, they usually translated something like his works before his work, or with his works or something. But it's the Hebrew says, his way. Where did we get the word way before? Where have we had that?
Yeah.
Right. Way is the distinctive characteristic of something. So what's distinctive characteristic of God? Wisdom. The impulse to create an order is really the essentials of God. You are actually describing a dimension of God. God's way. A way that was with God. And that way is portrayed as what? As something with a voice, and it's the voice of a woman. The inner characteristic, the driving characteristic of God is this voice, is this woman, is wisdom. The impulse to create. Impulse to order, impulse to design. Marvelous picture. So often you see we have this picture of God as a father sitting there, or a king sitting there ruling, when in fact just the opposite is portrayed here. Why doesn't that go on? God is portrayed as having beside him this driving, creative impulse called wisdom. Okay? So when God wants to do something in this text, God is always there from the beginning doing this. Now I want to take a look at Proverbs 8 and see just how this creative impulse, this voice, this feminine force in the cosmos, this feminine impulse in the cosmos is linked to what we've just been talking about. Alright, verse 23. Before the beginning of earth. Right? In other words, when God was creating the earth, we're back here. I was there. I was that creative impulse with God, in God, at the beginning. Verse 24. When there were no what? Deep. When there was no deep. We're back here. So all of these are the technical dimensions of the cosmos. All of those, when they were made, I was there. Verse 25, the mountains. Verse 26, the fields. Verse 27, when I created the
heaven.
Remember, heavens should really be translated in all these texts, sky. When I created the skies, I was setting the laws. So you've got this figure as a creative impulse behind all of these ways and laws. And we're going through the same picture that we just did in Job 38. Verse 28 and the deep. 29, the limits of the sea. Exactly the same. So what you've got in this chapter is using the same technical terms about the construction of the cosmos and saying that God's creative impulse called wisdom was there from the beginning. And to be there means to be involved. Not just to be observant. And the foundations of the earth, verse 29. Then comes a text which nobody, which is a great controversy about. I was there beside God, as that force with God, as if I were, what does your translation say?
Master workman.
Now there's two different translations of that. Either a little child, or a master workman, or a craftsman, or a designer. Now, everybody wants to be more nicely consistent and say, well, you can't have a child there. That doesn't work, does it? Or does it? Remember we said that God was always delighted in this whole thing? I have a hunch that the translation is the most literal one, which is that the wisdom was there like a child, not a child, but like a child. That, and if you have a child, there's a sense in which that child is the springboard, the impetus, the impulse for you to do things. So I'm quite happy with saying what the most logical translation is child, but they confusingly put it that way. If you look in the footnotes, you've probably said, or a little child. So beside God, with God, is this thing called wisdom, which is with God as the force which impels and drives God to create. And then comes the next line, which is something you should always remember. What was I doing with God? Just creating? What does it say? Rejoicing. That impulse to create is something that makes the world alive and joyful and something to celebrate. And I celebrate human beings as well, it says. Now, before I move on, is what I'm saying reasonably clear? This is trying to unravel a little bit the science of the ancient world and understand that in this picture, you've got a portrayal of God as the God who uses and has with God and is part of God this creative ordering impulse called wisdom. And wisdom is the impulse behind all creative forces in the universe. The code behind the code. The divine DNA. Whatever you want to call it. Fascinating. And if that's the case, I ask the question, if you go anywhere and if I go into the woods and I ask the question, do I connect at all with this? If I know about it now, if I know that behind all of this is this remarkable creative impulse, is it somehow revealed to me in some moment? Do I connect with Earth because I know that life force is the wisdom that God is with God. In a certain sense, the wisdom is God. God is not something sitting out there, but is the eternal driving impulse of life. Every time you see, well, I saw a marmot yesterday, I'd never seen one. I said, that's life, you know, I just sat there mesmerized by the thing. And I'm mesmerized by a little bird called a blue wren, which sits on Kangaroo Island whenever I go there and bounces around, and I have the sense of kinship with it and the mystery of the life force, its way, and behind which is God, the impulse of the universe.
But it's not an unordered impulse. And that's another dimension, is to understand what the relationships amongst things are that are, as in the Job passage, there's
structure,
surface, and then you get under it, and there's another, and another, and another.
It's ordered.
Yes, and if you go to this text which talks about the deep, it talks about structures of the deep, and then the recesses of the deep, there's another level behind that, so there's levels within levels here. And so you've got the sense in which all of these ways are connected. Yes, that's true. So it's not and the word design implies this ordering of the different distinctive ways of the cosmos. Yeah.
And there's great delight in that.
Oh, yes.
Well, who else plays with Leviathans?
Huh?
Who else plays with Leviathans?
Well, yes, when you go to Psalm 104, you also have the sense that God enjoys what's created. Yes. He not only says, wow, that's great when he creates in Genesis 1. But in Psalm 104, you have... The Psalm 104 is full of humour. Most of the time we just read it rather piously, you know. But it's actually full of life and humour and fun, you know. Because God makes bread and wine to gladden the heart and oil for celebrating and dressing up, all these wonderful things. And Leviathan, he plays to sport with. The word sport is the word that's used for the word Jacob when you have fun on your plane. And to sport with means you actually frolic. So Leviathan's like God's heavenly beach ball. You can play, it's just wonderful. Now, what time? How much time do I got left?
6:02. 13 minutes.
6:02? I was supposed to stop at 6. Anyway. We now have...
Huh? You missed that already, so...
too bad. You're going to have to... I've got to give you... To make the final connection, we need to now go to Genesis 1. All of this is background. If you know there's some science in it all, then you start to reread Genesis 1. And Genesis 1 starts off, "In the beginning God created the skies and the earth." That's the title. Verse 1, verse 2 says, "And the earth was..." Earth is the topic, title, character. "And the earth was..." What?
Formless void.
"Was still had not been ordered." So the creative impulse is not there. It has not been ordered. "Earth was void," or it was empty, had not... And what else was there?
Darkness.
Unfortunately, I don't want to rub this off again.
Darkness.
Okay. I'll just take a little corner here to describe. The earth is there. Here's earth. And in addition to earth, there is what? Darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And what else? Not purple. No, no, no.
Spirit.
The wind.
Wind. There's a wind. What else?
Water.
Right. So this thing called earth is deep in the water and deep in the darkness. So you can't see it, right? Right? You can't see it. So deep in the darkness, Earth is there. It's not as though it's not there. Earth is part of the beginning of things. And inside of that is a thing called the wind. And the wind, I would say, is the equivalent to the eighth light wisdom. It's the impulse. But more than that, there's another impulse that comes, which is a voice. A voice, which is the voice of God. And that voice, the voice of the wind. And in that middle of that, the first thing you need, if you're going to be able to see what's happening in the story, you need what?
Light.
Light. And light has nothing to do with the sun. A modern equivalent is something like energy. It's that force which you see. You have to put light there to be able to see what's going to happen. And in the elf, in the Aboriginal one that we have, it's actually lightning that comes out. So however it is, there's light there before you have anything else. Then the second, and God says that. Wow, that's good. Let's go on. Next day, God creates a sky. And we don't have time to talk about that, but the third day is the key day. That's the day when earth is finally what?
Ordered.
More than ordered. It says, let the earth appear. So what you have is this impulse from God, and earth emerges, evolves, whatever you want to use, out of the water. And the word, it says, let the earth appear. And that word there in Hebrew is equal to the same word that's used when God appears. A theophany, an appearance of God. So this portrait here is a portrait of how they, one of the metaphors for understanding the relationship of earth to the waters and the deep structures of things. And out of the depths of things, and out of the darkness, emerges earth. And then the next level of evolution or emergence, or impulse, so the first one is the impulse for earth to appear and be evident. The second is the impulse for what? Let the earth bring forth
vegetation
and plants. So impulse two are all the plants. And impulse three on day six is let the earth, or then impulse three is let the waters bring forth fish. And so they emerge out of the water. God doesn't say let there be fish or let there be plants. He says let the earth be the source of them. So earth is the source of life. The sea is the source of fish. And on the sixth day, God says, let their earth bring forth animals, calves, So in your evolutionary concept, everything emerges and evolves out of Earth. And so all of this concept of the impulse of life is linked to Earth, even in the Genesis 1 story, even though we've rarely read it. So what I'm suggesting is that when you walk through the woods, feel the impulses. Stay alive, because that life force fills not only you, but everyone. And every one of the things that are around you has that special, distinctive life force that links up with the great eternal impulse, the creative impulse of wisdom, which is God. Thank you.